This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Unregistered is still a completely listener-supported podcast. So, if you want to keep the show going, I need your help. To make a contribution, you can go to unregisteredlisteners.com. You'll receive access to the private Unregistered Facebook page where I discuss the ideas from the show with listeners. You'll also receive gifts of unregistered merchandise, transcripts of the interviews, autographed copies of my books, webinars on history, politics, culture, and philosophy, and a download of my 11-part video lecture course on A Renegade History of the United States. I really hope you can help me keep these remarkable conversations going. There's another way you can participate directly in conversations with me, like the ones on the podcast. There are still a few tickets left for a special weekend event with me in Salem, Massachusetts on August 5th and 6th. You can get all the information for the event at thaddeusrussell.com/courses/weekend. My guest this week is one of the very few journalists on the left who has remained skeptical of the apocalyptic claims about Trump and the alleged Russian conspiracy since the beginning of the presidential campaign. He's also one of the smartest critics of liberals and Democrats from the left, which is precisely why they hate him so much. If you aren't already following Michael Tracy, please do. I really mean this. It might actually help keep us out of World War III. So I'm here with a person I consider to be possibly the leading candidate for the Pulitzer Prize this year. And I mean that. This is Michael Tracy. He's a journalist. And to me, over the last year, year and a half, he's really done the best journalism of anyone I have seen on politics. And I really mean that. I would say certainly his Twitter account has been by far the finest Twitter account in America since early 2016. And his work on with Medium and now with the Young Turks, you'll see it just stands apart in many ways. Most obviously, he has not towed the line on the, I'm going to say it, the hysteria about Trump and Russia and Putin. And he has generally been not willing to go along with the idea that Trump was going to bring Armageddon, which led to much of the left and almost all liberals to hate him. So he's also one of the most hated people in the world, in the country. And that's another reason I like him a lot. So that's why he's here. And I've learned a lot from him. If you want to get a good sense of what is really happening with Russia and Putin and Trump and how the left thinks about those things, you should follow Michael Tracy right away, and you should read everything he has written over the last year and a half. There's really no one else. I mean, I would say, well, let me ask you this, Michael.
Well, first of all, I'm blushing, but go on.
Stop talking. Okay. I'm not done with you. No, I was going to say that you're almost alone. And you're a leftist. Okay, this is the other reason I love you. You're a leftist. You were a big Bernie supporter, right?
I did support Bernie in the Democratic primaries, yes, and I voted for him.
Yeah. Pretty enthusiastically, correct?
I would say yes. I mean, I had certain qualms, but relatively speaking, my vote was cast with enthusiasm.
And so that's why I love you too, because you're one of the very, very few leftists who does this. Now, there have been a handful of libertarians who have been okay on this stuff, on the hysteria about Putin and Russia, but most libertarians have been kind of quiet, I think cowed. And then some libertarians, of course, have been pro-Trump, which is no good either, in my view, and we'll get into that. But who are the other leftists who have not fallen victim to this hysteria?
Well, you know, leftist or leftism is not something that I overtly identify with all that much. When people try to probe me and make me classify myself ideologically, I would say that, yes, for the most part, over the years, I've more identified with the left, but I don't necessarily elevate leftists as a central identity in my life. So maybe that has to do even subconsciously with the fact that I've been pretty vociferous about this issue. But you know, just to address your question, who are some others that have talked about this in a way that I appreciate? Well, I mean, maybe this is overly I don't want to overly adulate him, and it's very easy for me to do so, but definitely Glenn Greenwald.
Yep.
And even with him, he's been accused of being everything across the board in terms of the ideological spectrum. You have certain factions on the left who believe that he's kind of like the stealth right libertarian. He gets accused of being a leftist. He gets accused of being almost anything you could dream up. And I think probably if you were to drill down, you would situate him more on the left. But it's just not a central fact of his existence, him being a leftist.
Mm-hmm.
Others I could cite, I think Matt Taibbi has done a lot of good work on this. I think, my colleague at the Young Turks, Jordan Chariton, has been pretty forceful in making some of the points that I've made. Stephen F. Cohen, who I just spoke to at length on the Young Turks about this, is somebody who has been immersed in progressive circles for much of his life. And he's been really a beacon of sanity on this topic.
I agree.
And then Katrina Vandenhoevel, Stephen F. Cohen's wife, she's also tried to push back on some of the excesses that have been emanating out of the, I would say, more center left than left, but the excesses overall that I think have been that I think have characterized this issue over the past year or so, and there are more that I could name, and I think there definitely is an appetite on the left for reasoned coverage of this topic. The trouble is that because Trump is such a dominant persona, everything gets analyzed in relation to Trump the persona, meaning considerations that otherwise ought to be viewed as very pressing, such as whether xenophobia is being stoked around this Russia issue, in the minds of many people, get subordinated to the overriding goal of opposing Trump by whatever means necessary. And if they view the Russia matter as a useful vehicle to weaken Trump and potentially even remove him from power, they are maybe going to switch off some of their critical faculties and say that it is worth it from, you know, a utilitarian standpoint. If your overarching goal is to hamstring Trump and force him from office, then maybe you're going to tolerate certain excesses that maybe ought not to be viewed as tolerable in other circumstances.
Okay. So why do liberals hate Trump so much? What do you think? They hate him more than your average Republican. I mean, they really, right? Am I right about this? It's deeper. I have an answer.
I'm actually curious to know what your answer is.
I'm testing you.
Okay. I think there are a lot of people who follow politics on a relatively superficial level. And a lot of those people are liberals, meaning, and I would call them as their cultural liberals. Their politics are animated by certain cultural signifiers that are associated with mainstream liberalism. And given that Trump is fundamentally a pop culture figure, so he emerged from the pop culture space, so to say, Whereas other GOP primary candidates in 2016 did all the kind of glad-handing and courting of party operatives that you would expect in the course of a presidential primary cycle, Trump circumvented all that and just went full-throatedly into the pop culture realm. I mean, that gave him a platform with the reality TV show that he was the host of for whatever it was, 12 years or something. And if viewing politics through the lens of pop culture is your sort of primary mode of political analysis, then given that Trump is such an outsized figure, that is perhaps going to conjure up additional strife within you that maybe another Republican would not. Mm-hmm. And I think that is an aspect of it. I think there are other reasons as well. But to me, that's one facet of why he's so loathed.
That he's a pop culture figure. That's why they hate him.
Yeah. And, you know, Mitt Romney wasn't a pop culture figure. Maybe he would have been opposed by liberals. But I don't think Mitt Romney ever engendered the visceral hatred that Trump did.
Why?
And I think that Trump – this is really interesting – I almost want to pull this up on my phone because I thought it was just so perfectly worded at the time. Elizabeth Brunig, who's really super intelligent.
She blocked me on Twitter a long time ago.
Oh, did she? That's unfortunate.
Long time ago.
I think you have a fruitful discussion with her.
Oh, my God. well, we certainly didn't, obviously.
Yeah, so it goes. But she had a really interesting observation a few months ago. And she basically said something along the lines of, She observed that the reaction to Trump among Sanders supporters and Clinton supporters was different. Among Clinton supporters, the reaction to Trump seems to be one of just constant alarmist, just meltdown, mm-hmm. And just visceral rage on a daily basis, kind of lurching from crisis to crisis. Whereas among Sanders supporters, the reaction to Trump is one just sort of like bemusement and disgust rather than this constant alarmism.
Is that really true for all of you, all the Bernie supporters?
Well, I mean, I think she was speaking in broad strokes.
Okay.
But, I mean, and maybe this was informed by, you know, social media. Mm-hmm. I think in social media, this is probably true in large part. You know, I just think whatever that she was getting at there – There's something to
it. Oh, she didn't have a deeper analysis? She didn't explain why this is?
No, it was just a kind of basic offer. I think it definitely warrants deeper analysis, and maybe I should do it or somebody should do it.
Well, we'll do it right now.
Okay, we'll do it right now.
Of course. That's what we're here for.
I think there's something to it. I think the most kind of just blithering rage about Trump comes from the center left. Mm-hmm. Like I was at this March for Truth in Los Angeles. It was nationwide, but there was one in Los Angeles a couple weeks ago.
And you almost threw hands with Maxine Waters.
Well, no comment.
There will be comment. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay. So that was interesting because normally street protests haven't been organized by the center left. If you look at the broad sweep of history in America, normally you'll have street action organized by the more thoroughgoing left, mm-hmm. and then they'll get liberals to begrudgingly sign on occasionally. Mm-hmm. But liberals won't have been the organizing driving force, right? Yeah. But this was different. This was sort of the inverse. And ironically, the center left seems to have the most vituperative reaction to Trump because I think they have they're culturally averse to him in a way that wasn't a live factor in the past. And I know that's just sort of the beginnings of an analysis, but that's just sort of an observation that I've had. Like if you had gone to a socialist protest, right, on that same day that was held somewhere else in Los Angeles, yeah, nobody would have been particularly favorably disposed to Trump, right? But it wouldn't have been this kind of mania about how Trump is ringing in the apocalypse. It would have been a little more of an emphasis on analyzing the structural factors which maybe gave rise to Trump, mm-hmm. and which Trump is only a kind of vulgar manifestation of. And I think on the center left, there is an inability to delve into that level of analysis. And that kind of just, I think, compels a lot of people to seek the emotional release of fixating on Trump as a person who you dislike strongly. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that tendency is very conducive to constructive politics.
Mm-hmm. So empirically, you could say that most of the criticism from the left of Trump has been characterological, correct?
I would say so, yes.
That's what you're saying. It's been about his personality, who he is as a person.
And by the way, Hillary Clinton encouraged that. Remember, she would bring up things like Trump maligning the Miss Universe 1996 as if the Miss Universe pageant from 1996 was the most pressing issue of the 2016 presidential mm-hmm. election. Mm-hmm. So Hillary Clinton, and actually I was traveling around the quote-unquote heartland at the, you know, kind of apex of the campaign. And I remember being in Cincinnati, Ohio, and the ads you'd be inundated with during like the World Series were all these characterological criticisms of Trump. It was, we can't allow our children to be subjected to such a poor role model.
Right.
I think you know, there's a through line there, and again, that line of criticism has been a constant throughout the Trump phenomenon, and it's led to a dearth of, I think, you know, decent political analysis.
Even the Russia stuff is mostly characterological, because to them, you know, it's a sign, if this stuff is true, which I don't think it is, but if it were true, that he's weak, this has been said, he's Putin's bitch.
It's a sign that he's treasonous.
Well, right. Okay, right. Which has a long history, that term.
And if he's treasonous, mm-hmm. that means there was some deep-seated characterological flaw mm-hmm. which gave rise to him mm-hmm. viewing treason mm-hmm. as something that he should pursue for reasons of political mm-hmm. opportunism. I mean, that would be a hugely damning indictment of him as a person if he were to have done that.
Right. He has no principles, no core, nothing you can trust.
Yeah. I think that probably is true, actually, that he has no principles and no core. I mean, it's a nuanced point. I think
Thank God. Right? I'd much rather have that, as dangerous as it is, and I think it is dangerous, but I think it's less dangerous than an ideological person.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why there was an argument that I can recall that Trump would be less bad than Ted Cruz, for example.
Yeah, a true believer. You don't want them in office.
But at the same time, I mean, I think what we've seen in the past couple months is that given that Trump has surrounded himself with kind of mainline Republican personnel – so Reince Priebus, for example, is his chief of staff. He's outsourcing a lot of legislative tasks to the Republicans in the Senate and the House. He's very, very praiseworthy of Paul Ryan and others. I think given Trump's overall malleability, that just gives the Republican establishment, who basically exists to serve the oligarchic class. mm-hmm. I mean, there are some distinctions there. Obviously, the Democrats do as well in certain senses. But whatever the Republican oligarchic class is, those people are now seeing their interests advance to some degree because Trump's malleability allows for the people who are around him and who can give him the right kind of positive reinforcement end up being the ones who have leverage over him on a policy level.
Yeah, I mean, I think since he's actually taken office, he's become what I feared, which is an easy vessel for whoever wants to fill it. And the people who can fill it, who are positioned to fill it, are who you're talking about, the old Republican establishment and the old foreign policy establishment, the generals who I think are running the show now. But again, we'll get to that in a second. So why do liberals hate Donald Trump so much? So you point to him being a pop culture figure, and you point to the overwhelming fixation on his characterological flaws.
Just to interject very briefly.
Yeah.
And I also want to just acknowledge, because I know this would be the first criticism that I were to get if that thought was like tweeted out in tweet form, But I want to just acknowledge that there are also legitimate policy reasons to.
Yeah, but they don't care about those.
Well, I mean, I think.
Not much.
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who do actually take sincere offense to, say, the travel ban or the Muslim ban or whatever you want to call that policy and view it as.
Is that really
genuinely harmful?
How could that be sincere if they didn't care much or even care to notice that Obama did as much or worse?
I think they have a superficial analysis.
Right.
So I think that the care they displayed with respect to the travel ban was sincere. They sincerely felt that it was going to bring about harm on vulnerable populations, which I think is true. Now, could they still be hypocritical and not extend that analysis to indict various things that Obama did? Yeah, I think they can be hypocritical, but I wouldn't necessarily doubt their sincerity. I just think it's just surface level sincerity.
Yeah, no, I think the sincerity about the ban itself, the policy, is surface level. I don't think it's actually real. I think what's real, very sincere, is their hatred of the man.
So you don't think that the people who went to the airports to protest, like liberal lawyers and activists in New York City and Washington, D.C., you don't think any of them had a sincere aversion to the policy?
Only those who said anything about what Obama's had been doing to Muslims for years, would be about 1% of them. How could you possibly think that these people are sincere about that when they said nothing when Obama was obliterating Muslims, killing them, surveilling them, banning them from entering the United States, you name it, for years and years. They said nothing. So no, I don't actually think they were sincere about that. Here's what I think
you can be both sincere and hypocritical.
I don't know. It's like a fleeting sincerity maybe at best,
yeah.
Right? So
And again, the whatever sincerity that they harbored about the travel ban was amplified by the other factors which lead them to view Trump as uniquely vulgar or bad.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I want to try to be charitable to liberals, which is not something that I do very often.
Yeah.
But I do think that there was a sincere belief that this would harm vulnerable populations. And in over the course of my personal reporting, I believe that is true. I do think that vulnerable populations were harmed by it. You know, I spoke to Iraqi refugees in the Southern California area who were, I think, unjustly negatively impacted by that action that Trump took.
Sure.
So I do think that there are certain liberals, again, acknowledging that maybe their analysis isn't as broad-based as it ought to be and doesn't indict as much of the political class generally as it should.
Mm-hmm.
I think those – you have to kind of take them at their word on some level that they do believe – that this was just genuinely harmful. Again, I think, you know, I think objections to the travel ban are the best place to actually oppose Trump on a policy level rather than a characterological level.
Mm-hmm.
I just think, again, that all the characterological factors enhance and amplify for a lot of people what. And even this healthcare stuff that's going on right now, I think there's legitimate reasons to be extremely critical of what the Republicans are proposing anyway. You know, cuts to social spending and so on. So I think it's just it's a confluence of factors, and I think that the characterological stuff is a distortion. But I wouldn't want to be overly dismissive of the genuine criticisms that certain people have.
So Obama let the big pharma companies write the healthcare bill that is Obamacare. People loved it. That makes no sense to me. What makes sense is that they care who is doing it, not what is being done.
Yeah.
So let's go back to your other shrewd observation, which is that the left, and I guess this would mean like socialists, right? Far left types, socialists, and I guess sort of hard identity politics types. Non-liberal leftists.
Well, I mean, there's.
I think you're right. Hang on. I think you're right about that. That they've had a cooler reception or cooler response to Trump, meaning they haven't freaked out about it as much. I agree with that. Why do you think? This is another quiz.
Uh huh. Well, I mean, I think they.
There is a right answer.
Because I think they have a structural analysis. I think they're overriding. Principle when they look out on the political scene is a certain structural analysis, and they only view Trump as a vulgar manifestation of it rather than a be-all, end-all. And they don't view it as prudent to let opposition to Trump be what defines their political style.
Mm-hmm.
Because that creates the impression that if you were to remove Trump, then somehow everything would magically...
They have a structural analysis in that they think that the entire structure is illegitimate and needs to be replaced, right?
Right.
Yeah, so when I was about 10 years old, I heard about some liberal Democrat in California, I forget who it was, and I got really excited because it sounded like he was a good guy, and I came home and told my mom, "Mom, we should vote for so-and-so," and she said, "Oh, he's a Democrat." I said, "What's wrong with that?" She said, "They're just one wing of the ruling class."
Right.
And I felt ashamed. I thought, oh my God, I'm sorry. You're right, Mom. I didn't realize they were just one wing in the ruling class. I'll go tell my fifth grade teacher this. I learned a lot about left-wing politics right then, in a particular socialist and revolutionary or radical left-wing politics, which is that the Democratic Party is that they are considered to be, you know, just one part of this overall structure that is no good. So what did that mean? Hang on. What did that mean psychologically? It meant I was crushed in that moment because I had, here's what happened, Michael. I had for a moment identified with a Democrat, with a liberal, part of the establishment, right? And that's why I felt so bad because my mother said in that moment, in effect, yeah, he's not your dad. He's not one of us. He's not family. See, this is what it's about. And since then, when I was a leftist and whatever I am now since then, I've maintained this distance, this psychological distance from both parties, politicians generally, any agent of the state. You know, I'd never allow myself to get sentimental about any of them. Mm-hmm. So sure, there were moments when Obama played some notes that mm-hmm. sounded pretty good to me musically and hit me pretty deeply, but I was pretty good at parrying them. I deflected mm-hmm. them. I remained cold-hearted and dry-eyed throughout the entire Obama phenomenon while I was being disgusted at all my friends who were crying at everything he said. and that goes for, you know, every politician that I've encountered since I was 10 years old. And I think that's the difference. So people on the left, I mean the real left, not liberals, right? That's how they are different fundamentally psychologically from liberals. Liberals identify with those who are in government. They identify with the leaders of the state.
Another thing is...
leftists don't because they don't control the state. Now, the problem with them, of course, is they want to control the state so that eventually they will be identifying with the heads of state. What leftists in this country do instead of identifying with our political leaders is what? They identify with political leaders who have held the reins of power outside the United States. Okay.
So can I interject now?
No.
Okay,
nope.
Oh wait.
So the problem with Trump is that he is the father you don't want to have. Obama was the father you want to have. Bill Clinton was the father you want to have. Mitt Romney wasn't great, but he was tolerable because at least in the way he conducted himself, he didn't embarrass us around our friends. You know, like when your dad does stuff in public, when your dad says something kind of racist, this is mortifying to liberals, right?
Right.
And this is exactly what's going on. I mean this. So when the president for them is that office is something they identify with, and they want to have John F. Kennedy there and Barack Obama in there forever. And every once in a while, we let down our guard and let in the embarrassing, alcoholic, kind of racist, slovenly, kind of sexist stepfather take control and become the president. And then we have to go around with all of our friends and they get to see this asshole. And it's embarrassing because we are associated with him. That's why they hate Trump so much, because he's the wrong dad.
I think there's a lot of truth to what you just said. I think liberals, in addition to identifying with the apparatus of state when the state is controlled by somebody that they identify with culturally, They also have a strong affinity for what they call norms.
Mm.
And
exactly.
What they like to refer to as, you know, the inviolability of American institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And if they view Trump as discrediting those institutions, which they often do, and in fact, liberals you've seen increasingly align with neoconservatives who have been hostile to Trump and making this argument. David Frum comes to mind. He's constantly whining about norms being eroded.
Yeah.
I think that sets them apart from leftists in another sense, which is that leftists tend to view those norms as facilitating the preservation of an unjust system.
Yeah.
So therefore, they're not personally offended as much when they see Trump coming along and rattling off insane comments, which say undermine NATO,
mm-hmm.
or undermine various kind of natural or even supranational structures
mm-hmm.
that leftists tend to view as mere instruments of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And so liberals seem to be very incensed by Trump as somebody who is degrading discourse and who makes American institutions, which they had wanted to hold in high regard, look less positive.
Yeah, he's discrediting their family. This is what it is. It's
right.
Their family.
And I think for, especially for a certain class of liberals, so I remember being in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration, and I would talk to people in liberal kind of policy circles and people who kind of move in the world of the people who had just assumed that they were all going to get into positions of power once that mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton ascended. And for them, it was very important that American prestige be maintained on the world stage and even domestically. And they thought that the Democrats and liberalism are what allows for the most fruitful preservation of American prestige.
Yeah.
So and they didn't know anybody, and they had nobody in their circles who felt otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And actually this extended to Bernie Sanders in a way. If you talk to people in the think tank space, quote unquote, what I would often hear is that people who supported Bernie Sanders during the Democratic primaries in those circles often took the brunt of even greater hostility and rage than a Trump supporter might have. Partially because, I don't know, maybe you maintain special indignation for people who are a little more proximate to you in terms of ideological affiliation.
Stay with the family metaphor, Michael. It works again. It works again. See, you get most angry at your family.
Mm-hmm.
So when leftists get angry at me, or if they say something I think is stupid, I get enraged still, because that still, even though I'm not really leftist anymore, still that's my family.
Mm.
Right? When conservatives do something stupid on Fox News, I never care at all.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't want them to be president, but I don't care. It doesn't bug me. When they attack me, and I've been attacked by conservatives, right? They'll yell at me about this or that. I laugh at them. It has no effect on me.
Mm.
But if you get some little dummy 20-year-old Bernie fan screaming at me on Twitter, even though I think he's stupid, it kind of gets to me. It hits a nerve, because that's my family. So that's what I'm getting at here. There's a deep psychological attachment and identification with government, with the presidency, with Congress, with state power generally, by liberals, right? And for liberals, it's this particular state power that exists now, right? And that's their family. And so they got the drunk, they got the alcoholic stepfather running the family now, and it's mortifying.
And
you're right. It's cultural. I think it is all cultural, but I think that's what's going on.
I don't think it's all cultural. I just think the cultural factor is massive and tends to be given too little weight when people talk about why Trump is so loathed. But this sort of relates to a point that I had wanted to make about the distinction between how Trump is perceived between liberals and the left. Mm-hmm. I think what a lot of leftists rightly assume is that the center-left establishment, so the Center for American Progress, the affiliated media organs, you know, the mainstream of the Democratic Party, I think what leftists rightly suspect is that those entities are using this Trump outrage basically as a way to rehabilitate their image. So they're feeding the more superficial kind of Trump indignation under the banner of the resistance with the little trademark logo. And I think people on the left take umbrage with that because it sort of means that the face of the opposition, whatever, you know, however broadly defined, is being monopolized by people whose politics they view as having failed.
Mm-hmm. So there's two different groups we're talking about here. One is Democratic Party operatives and leaders, right? People
and affiliated sort of media.
People who have institutional power through the Democratic Party or are seeking it. Okay, that's one group. And then the other group is just the sort of broad mass of liberals, right? Mm-hmm. For the broad mass of liberals, I am totally convinced it's cultural and psychological in the ways I've described. That it's superficial, the stuff about policy, they don't really care. But what they do care about is having the right dad in office. Now,
I just want to interrupt really quickly. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So, I mean, do you think for the broad mass of liberals who, for example, right now are raising hell about the Republican health care proposal, you don't think that
they're not?
I mean, they sort of are. I mean, they flooded town hall meetings from Republican representatives.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, some are, sure. But
yeah, so I mean, I think when you say it's – I mean, I grant and I agree that the cultural thing is huge.
Do you think they know what's in the bill?
Well, I mean, I think if they're told that there's going to be Medicaid cuts, and there are apparently, mm-hmm. then if that produces within them outrage, I think there's legitimacy to that. Again, I think the cultural factor is huge.
Yeah.
And it kind of overlays everything, right? And amplifies everything. But I think you can't be just so uniformly dismissive of actual policy informing, at least having an impact on why people feel the way they do.
Okay, fine. I mean, sure. I mean, eventually when people see the checks get reduced that they get in the mail, or right, fine. But I think 90%+ of this stuff is characterological and psychological. I think if Hillary Clinton had introduced exactly the same bill or had pushed the exact same bill, there would have been, don't you agree, far less pushback.
Sure. And I think, I'm thinking back to Obamacare in like 2009-10. You know, that was the Mitt Romney healthcare plan.
Thank you.
And yet it produced almost near universal opposition among Republicans.
So there was
a psychological aversion among Republicans to the Obama plan. So it kind of runs in both directions.
As I said, big pharma, representatives from big pharma and the health insurance industry, I didn't mention that, literally came to the White House and sat down at a table and wrote that bill with Obama's staff. Literally. Yeah. Did we care? No, we loved it. We thought it was great. And we still do. Because Obama he dresses nicely and he uses English properly and he doesn't say things that might be construed as racist or sexist. We're so proud of him. We're so glad to have him as a dad that we will take him. We love it when he shows up at our Little League game. We do.
But I'm saying the Republican opposition to that plan, given that it was a Republican plan, they had really no good policy concerns. Mm-hmm. That was also largely psychological, right?
Yeah.
Because they viewed the guy overseeing the legislative process as a stealth.
See, Michael, here's the problem, Michael. Yeah. Here's the problem that you have and I have.
Okay.
You and I care a lot about all of this stuff and we study it deeply and we know all this stuff. We spend much of our lives reading this stuff, thinking about it, talking about it, really knowing it, really caring about it. Here's the problem, Michael, Tracy. You and I are in a very, very small minority of Americans.
True.
This is the fundamental bedrock problem. This is the torture we face every day. When I wake up in the morning gripped with anxiety and despair, that is basically why. It's because I am alone in this world. And I don't mean...
You're not totally alone. I'm with you right now.
There's four of us. And I don't mean because I have weird ideas about politics. It's because I have any ideas about politics that I actually care about politics. So I think this is true for paleo conservatives. I think this is true for a lot of real, true conservative intellectuals. It's true for some liberal intellectuals even, maybe. But when you really are focused on this stuff, when it's this central in your life, it's just hard to live here. Don't you think?
Well, yeah, I think it's a huge imperative for journalists in particular. And I guess almost that it would extend to anybody who wants to comment on politics and have a public platform. It's incumbent to recognize just that the centrality with which you view political affairs is not something that the vast, vast, vast majority of your fellow countrymen share.
Right.
So you have to make an effort to extricate yourself from these kind of rarefied social circles where politics is a major issue constantly, day in and day out, and immerse yourself in other ways of life. Otherwise, you're going to lose perspective on how most people in America conceptualize what politics is.
You know what makes it even worse? Makes me just suicidal is that the political people, the people who do, don't take this as anything. Don't worry about it. It's not about you. The people who are political intellectuals, I don't really like hanging out with them.
Me neither, for the most part.
Yeah. So what do I do then? I just, you know, I'm an alien all the time. Uh-huh. I'm just always an alien from outer space.
Well, you could do the Mark Zuckerberg thing and go on this very stilted PR tour of like farm country in Iowa. Have you seen this?
Yeah. How would that help me? Those people aren't political intellectuals, so I will be frustrated there. I might want to hang out with them, but yeah. I can't talk about politics with them.
Right.
Nor
well, you can talk about politics with them, but you're going to be talking about it with them from a standpoint of somebody who is just very tangentially aware of politics.
Yeah, no, I mean,
which is how most Americans experience it. So it's worthwhile to do that.
When it comes to just hanging out, that's who I want to hang out with. Right. That's who I do hang out with. Since I moved to Oregon and not Portland, I live in Salem. You know, that's who I've been hanging out with. In fact, more of those types, and it's great. It's just I just feel much more relaxed. I mean, I'm not fully satisfied, of course, because I am interested in politics and ideas and Michel Foucault and all this stuff. You know, uh-huh. And I can't talk about this stuff, but that's fine for the most part. I am just calm and relaxed around them. Whenever I'm around political people and intellectuals, it's much more stimulating in that way, but it's either a fight or I feel like a fight is about to jump off. Always. And that's not me being paranoid. That's just the way we are. There is always sort of a competition going on.
Yeah.
And it's a competition.
There's always a fight just under the surface that could easily explode.
And it's a competition that's much, much more dire than, say, sports, because there's a morality attached to it. So if you have the wrong ideas about politics, then you're a bad person, mm-hmm. right? Most political intellectuals have that. It's sort of an article of faith. It's awful, but that's at stake too. So you're constantly thinking, oh God, he not only disagrees with me on Obamacare, he thinks I'm a bad person.
Right.
For having my position on
Obamacare. I almost respect viewing somebody as a bad person if you think that their political views are anathema. Because if you look at like the political consultant class, like the operatives,
yeah.
who jump back and forth advising candidates who are diametrically opposed to one another at times, like, yeah, I can even think back to, you know, different primary races where the candidates would be just vicious toward one another, and then one drops out, and then all their operatives flock to whoever the rival candidate was. Mm-hmm. You would think if you were actually working for that campaign for principled reasons, that you'd be morally averse to just capitulating and getting on board with that rival candidate.
Yeah.
So I think there's. And I think that speaks to a certain superficiality that I think is really present in much of the operative class. Because if you had viewed somebody you didn't disagree with as a bad person, then you can't align with them for reasons of kind of professional opportunism.
I struggle with this too. Like, should I hate people who have the wrong politics? And I think I figured this out. I think it's when their ideas are aligned with state power in ways that would be deadly to me or others, and they have a platform on which to affect policy, then I think I can hate them. But then, as I'm saying that, I'm thinking literally of a couple of friends of mine who I've had arguments with publicly about this very thing. When it comes to foreign policy, I was thinking about this recently. I've been having debates with a couple people in public about foreign policy and NATO and what it really means and the potential for a draft and a world war, and my son is 15 years old. Okay? So there you go. I have some skin in the game there, potentially. So looking at the Middle East right now, we have the Shia-Sunni conflict, which has been there for a long, long time, led by the Saudis, or the Sunni leaders of the Sunni faction, and Iran, the leaders of the Shia faction. Now they have very clear, sort of coherent sets of allies. We have Russia aligning with Iran. We have the United States, of course, has been aligning with Saudi Arabia for a long time. Israel is there with the Sunnis very clearly now, which is new, by the way. We have, and then, of course, the Syrian army is with the Shia, and the Kurds are with the Sunnis. And Turkey, Erdogan, where I'm just sort of waiting for him, because he's a big waffler, to pick a side. He's gone back and forth between the two. But once he picks a side and something happens in the Middle East, and something could happen at any day, right? And we have Trump in office, and it's not Trump in office now who's running foreign policy. It's Jim Mattis and McMaster running foreign policy. And if the Iranians do something particularly provocative, right, they have this whole alliance with them now. And the Sunnis, the Saudis, and the U.S. and Israel have a whole alliance with lots and lots of armies on both sides. We could have World War III. I think it's a real possibility now. So I raised this when I was arguing with these guys who think the United States should be a part of NATO, and that if Russia did anything expansive or aggressive, we should kill a bunch of Russian conscripts to defend some NATO member like Estonia. Or if Iran did something particularly provocative, you know, NATO should come to it, should defend whoever Iran attacks. It's world war, right? Potentially, we're talking about. And once it's a world war, then a draft is on the table as a possibility. And my son's 15 years old, so I could see all this happening within 3 years. So if I hear someone advocating those kinds of positions, right? We should go to war if this or that happens against these massive armies, and my son might be forced to serve. And even if he's not forced to serve, we're talking about lots and lots of people getting killed on either side or both sides. What should I think about them as friends, Michael Tracy? What should I do? I don't know. I'm struggling with this right now.
I don't know either, really. I'm thinking now of the way that a lot of liberals and Democrats are talking about this Republican health care proposal. They are saying literally that this will kill hundreds of thousands of people, or I don't know, whatever figure they might cite.
Right.
So if you genuinely believe that, if you genuinely believe that the Republicans are implementing a policy which will cause the deaths of scores of thousands of people, how can you go and have just a brotherly conversation with them at the pub that night? I mean, you ought not to. Otherwise, you're not being honest about what your beliefs are.
I know. What do we do? What do we do? Really? You know, and then there's libertarians who think that taxation is theft, right?
Right.
At the point of a gun. And you know what? Here's the thing. I think they're right. I mean, I think the analysis is correct. That's what it is. I don't choose to pay these taxes. If I don't pay the taxes, they take me to jail at the point of a gun. It's true. So then what do I do? Because 99% of Americans think we should pay taxes. I should be forced to pay some taxes. Even conservatives do, right? To support the fucking military, right? Who will kill my son. So then what do I do? What do we do? Man, I'm telling you, we're aliens. You and I.
No, I mean, I think you have to, I think people are forced to compartmentalize these things.
That's what I try to do.
It's just, man. And maybe that's worthy. Maybe you don't want to treat political disagreement as some kind of extremely damning personal indictment of whoever your interlocutor is.
I'll tell you
At the same time, at the same time, you're sort of making a concession almost in a way if you don't view it that as a living factor in how you perceive somebody as a person. I mean, if you think somebody's political beliefs will result in mass suffering and death, I don't see how you can neglect that in terms of creating a characterological profile of the person.
And whether you choose to have drinks with them.
Yeah.
And hang out with them.
Yeah.
Right? It's depressing. Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. If you had the chance and could go back to when was the year that – how old were you when you became political?
I can mostly – I remember – I think I became political probably around the Iraq War.
Right. So how old were you?
So I would have been 14 or so.
Okay. So if you could go back to that moment and then erased all the political thoughts you've had since then, would you do it? If you could go back in time and changed your life, your mind, so that you'd never cared about politics in these ways, would you do it?
Well, probably not, because in that alternate timeline, I'd probably be sitting in a cubicle somewhere just punching numbers and going home and having a very banal life.
Yeah, but you'd be so much happier and you'd have friends.
I don't know that I would have. I don't know that I would be happier necessarily. I think there's a potential where you can derive pleasure from this sort of conflict.
Yeah,
because it's stimulating.
That's true.
Because it puts you at the center of really consequential debates.
True.
So there's a way that I think you can take satisfaction, intellectual satisfaction, in being immersed in this sort of lifestyle.
I don't know, man.
But then again, you think maybe just a guy who sits around and derives enjoyment every weekend by watching the game and
that's what I'm saying.
Drinking beers with friends and going fishing, maybe he also has a satisfying life.
Imagine being able to watch a TV show and not have an analysis of it.
Yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. You know, to be able to watch a movie and not have an analysis of it,
uh-huh.
A political analysis of it. That sounds good. And I've seen people watch movies who appear to not have a political analysis of the movie, uh-huh. And they seem to be enjoying themselves. I'm just saying, I kind of envy them, and I wonder.
But if maybe you're getting a deeper
enjoyment. Would I be better off? I think I might be.
Maybe you're getting a deeper enjoyment, though, because with those additional layers of analysis, you're reaching into certain realms or something that maybe aren't accessible to most people, so they don't even know.
Well, yeah, of course. But I'm saying it's not a happy place to be. You know what Socrates said?
Maybe being constantly happy isn't. I mean, maybe being constantly
happiness is overrated.
Well, I mean, I think being in a state where you're constantly seeking pleasure isn't necessarily conducive to happiness.
That's what I want.
You do want that.
Okay. Oh yeah, of course. I'm a hedonist. So what I did is I did this total weird thing where I tried to combine the intellectualism with the hedonism. Right. Mm-hmm. So my arguments are all about, about hedonism, about let's be anti-puritanical and let's embrace as a politics
pleasure.
I read
pleasure. Your book. I remember.
Yeah, yeah. So that's it. So that's what I've tried to do. It doesn't work because I'm still just a fucking intellectual. I'm still have all these cultural analyses. I can't watch a movie or an HBO show without having some deep political analysis of it rather than just enjoying the fucking thing. I can't watch a football game basically without thinking about the politics of race and sports and whatever. You name it. I don't know. Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. And at the time when I first saw that, when I was 19 years old in college, I thought, are you sure? I don't know. And now I'm convinced of it. I think the examined life is impossible to live. You're too young. I shouldn't be doing this to you. You have a whole career ahead of you.
No, but I mean, I think unexamined and examined lives can both be worth living in different respects.
I'm working on it. I don't know what to do. Anyway, all right, look, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. So you are one of, how many did we identify? Four people, more or less on the left, who have not fallen into the hysteria. And more than that, here's what
There are people who haven't fallen into the hysteria who just don't talk about it much, but there are other people who at least actively try to rebut the hysteria.
Here's what I would call you.
And that's a smaller group.
Here's what I would call you and your four comrades.
It's a little more than four.
Five.
Around 10.
Nine. I call you anti-anti-Trump.
Yeah.
Trumpists, I guess. Anti-anti-Trumpists, right? Is that fair?
I don't really think so. I think it's sort of reductive. I mean, I've been accused of that now repeatedly. And I think latching onto that label is a way to distill, just kind of lazily distill certain political impulses that you're observing into a pithy
You're critics word. Of the anti-Trump phenomenon.
Right, but people will take anti-anti-Trump to mean pro-Trump. Because by discrediting his most...
No, that's why I use that term.
But I'm saying by criticizing his most visible opponents, you're therefore assisting Trump in some way.
Okay.
I just reject that. I actually think that being anti-anti-Trump, if you want to define that as being critical of the hysterical overreaction to Trump and the irrationality, I think that could very easily be construed as anti-Trump. Because the lazy criticisms don't meaningfully inhibit Trump. In fact, they might empower him in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a little in question now because the overweening focus on Russia has created a set of political circumstances where Trump maybe is genuinely hamstrung or he has real political liabilities now that he has to contend with. But... Anti-anti-Trump. I mean, why can't what's the point of coining these terms? That's what I don't like.
Michael, here's the thing. I think this is correct. Every single day for more than a year, you have tweeted more than once a day something criticizing the anti-Trump people. Correct?
Well,
yes.
I guess. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I have not seen anyone else do that. Glenn Greenwald does it once every 3 days. Doug Henwood does it maybe once a day or once every 2 days. You do it multiple times a day, and you have been doing it for more than a year. I think that's fantastic. That's why you deserve the Pulitzer Prize. Here's the question I want to ask you about that. Why are you nearly singular in that way? What is it about you and your history that brought you to this place, right? There's a particular, I don't know what it is, but you have a particular psychology that put you there. You clearly didn't identify with the Democratic Party or the state as much as liberals have. I guess that's part of it, but why? Like, does that make sense as a question?
I would maybe quibble with some of the premises of the question.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
I just don't know how singular I am, really. I just named to you a couple of people who I think in broad strokes share the criticisms that I've been leveling maybe a little more frequently than they.
A lot.
But, well,
it's
I don't
a
know.
Good thing. It's
I
a great
know.
Thing.
I mean, if you want to just gauge it based on frequency of tweets, perhaps.
This is your identity. You've gained an identity, which I think is a great one, okay? You're my hero. Don't get me wrong. But that's really who you've become. I mean, if people who are aware of you now would say that first. You're the guy who's the anti-anti-Trump leftist.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
So why?
I think the reality of social media is that you do develop an identity around whatever it is that you might...
You have some kind of passion
focus
for this.
Well, I mean, the passion doesn't stem from wanting to really give it to people who are anti-Trump. It stems from just a principled aversion to many of the tactics that they've employed for cynical purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they've done has resulted in a whole host of deleterious consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, it failed at meaningfully restraining Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it created a set of perverse incentives on Trump where now he – and we saw this when he bombed the Syrian airfield in April, where now it's viewed as politically advantageous for him to show how tough he is on Russia. And as you laid out before, being tough on Russia isn't just about Russia. It's about the whole balance of power now in the Middle East, in Europe. And when could
When he bombed Syria, that was when he was presidential, they all said.
Yes.
The liberals.
A lot of them did say that.
Yeah, a lot of them.
And they very cynically said, oh, Trump bombing Russia means that all the criticisms of Hillary as being a hawk during the election are now negated because, look, Trump is worse or something. Mm-hmm. Well, no, he's basically acquiesced to the policy that she had been advocating.
Right.
And actually, she had demanded that it be taken much further with the imposition of a no-fly zone and so forth. I mean, I think the bombing was idiotic. Mm-hmm. But the policy that Hillary had promoted over and over during the campaign would have been a lot worse.
A no-fly zone over Syria, right?
Yeah, the initiation of basically full-scale war.
At a time when Russia was every day flying sorties over Syria. So this no-fly zone effectively meant having to shoot down Russian warplanes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, that would have been nice.
You know, I think maybe what, if you want to kind of reduce it to a psychological explanation, I'm a little wary about for a whole host of a variety of reasons.
I think it's useful. I don't want to reduce anything, but I do think it can illuminate things.
Well, I think I balk when I see a conformity of opinion that seems to be going unchallenged, or when there are contradictions bolstering that conformity which have gone unprobed. And when probing those contradictions might illuminate various pathologies within the liberal class, in this instance, that I think really speak to significant issues that harm the polity.
Yeah.
So maybe that is my psychological motivation. I mean, look at the way that this Russia issue has functioned for a lot of Democrats and just for the political establishment writ large. It's been used as a way to constrict acceptable opinion, meaning when they talk about Russia's motive for supposedly interfering in the election, what they'll say is that Russians sought to create uncertainty about American institutions. They sought to breed suspicion about the veracity of the American way of life, or about various facets of
democracy.
American governance, of American democracy. Mm-hmm. They're trying to upend the liberal order. That's what you hear constantly, right?
Right.
And they'll say that, look, Russia sought to cultivate fringe figures on both the right and the left. Jill Stein showed up at this RT dinner along with Michael Flynn, and that's supposed to mean that Russia is trying to fertilize dissenting opinion on any end of the spectrum which might serve their ultimate goal of undermining American legitimacy.
Right.
So that's the way that this is sort of being used ideologically, and it's restricting the acceptable range of opinion that people can have, because if you veer too far outside the mainstream, that can be said to be somehow indicative of you being a Russian stooge. And if you look at how people who have testified before Senate committees have talked about this, that have been called before these committees, and that the senators in both parties nod solemnly in affirmation when they hear these lines being uttered, the witnesses will say things like people who published – who circulated WikiLeaks documents were useful idiots of the Kremlin. People who even do anything which can be said to advance Russian state goals somehow are useful idiots of the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. Meaning anything which maybe portrays NATO in a less than positive light, that is being depicted as advancing the aims of the Russian government.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it creates this ideological stranglehold that I think is very stifling.
I think you're totally right that they're attempting to do that. Liberals are using the anti-Russia hysteria to discredit their opponents on the left, interestingly, like Jill Stein, like Bernie Sanders, right? Much of the fire has been directed at Bernie and the bros.
Yeah.
And what they've said is that, you know, by allowing these fringe so-called elements, these ultra-left, whatever they want to call them, you know, leftist elements to have any influence in American politics, we get Trump. Mm-hmm. Right. And by the way, I just heard someone else say this about identity politics, that identity politics on campuses, and I'm no fan of Jill Stein, Bernie Sanders, or identity politics, but I do like the fact that they are different ideas. Anyway, this person was saying that identity politics gave rise to Trump. That's a very common argument made, right? That the Trump phenomenon was a reaction to identity politics on campuses, which I think is a little bit overblown. I think it's a lot overblown, this idea, but I think maybe is a small part of it. But anyway, the idea being that we need to shut up and go along with good old-fashioned ideas, right? That these new ideas that Bernie Sanders brought, that Jill Stein brought, that these campus radicals have brought, are really the problem. They will bring the devil. That's what's right. So it's discrediting anything that is outside the mainstream. I think you're completely right about that. Here's the question, though. How effective are they in doing this? Is this successful? I'm not sure about that at all. I think it's more likely now that we're going to have someone like Bernie be president.
I think that's probably true. I think it depends who you're referring to. For example, if you look at aspiring career operatives in Washington, D.C., I think the prospect of them taking a less than mainstream view and having it be attributed to some kind of Russian influence campaign is probably a pretty formidable obstacle to them voicing that view. So I think if you're talking about climbing the career ladder, I think the demonization of these views has been effective.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But no, we're not talking about people on the ladder. Trump was not on the ladder. Bernie wasn't on the ladder.
Yeah, but I'm saying you asked, has this constriction of acceptable opinion been effective?
Mm-hmm.
And I think among a certain class of people, yes.
Yeah, the, the people in the establishment, they're policing themselves more effectively now. But are they stopping people outside the establishment from coming in, people like Trump and Bernie?
Well, I mean, I think it's been even effective, even if you just kind of narrow your frame of reference to the progressive media. So not the liberal media. So conservatives have a criticism of liberal media, and they'll say that the New York Times and NPR and so forth are all part of this liberal media cabal. So that's not what I'm referring to. I'm referring like to Mother Jones and maybe MSNBC and kind of affiliated organs. I think the Russia hysteria has been very effective in making the view that détente with Russia is desirable, or that maybe sanctions on Russia are ill-advised, or skepticism of the aims of NATO as currently constituted are warranted.
Yeah.
I think the hysteria has succeeded in associating all those viewpoints with Trump and thereby the kind of reactionary right.
Yeah.
And I think it's created a set of incentives where now voicing that opinion would always have to be prefaced with, I'm not in favor of Trump, but maybe he has a point on this, that, or this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so if you're talking about the efficacy of the hysteria in terms of constricting acceptable opinion, at least with respect to those circles, which granted are pretty insular, or it doesn't have a whole lot of bearing on the public writ large. But if you're talking about those particular circles, yes, it has had an effect.
I think you're right. It's had an effect so far. We're 5 months into this presidency, right?
But we're a year now into the hysteria.
Okay, a year, fine. I think the hysteria is quieting a bit, isn't it? Since the election, certainly it is. And so I think, here's the thing. One of the great things is I have, for the first time in a long time, talked about things like NATO and like Article 5 and like the fact that the United States and any signatory to the NATO agreement is obligated to come to the defense of any member of NATO, right? Americans don't know that.
Right.
So it's one of my missions lately has been to yell that when I walk down the street and every time I do anything to tell people, go read Article 5. Do you understand that if Estonia is attacked, we are on the hook to defend Estonia potentially with our lives,
right?
Or the lives of Russian conscripts, right? People don't know that.
And during the campaign, I can remember any it was just taken as a given in the commentariat that the idea that American lives should be sacrificed over some kind of skirmish in Estonia.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
A country that most Americans have never heard of.
Yeah.
Never heard of. Yeah, we should sacrifice ourselves and other people for that. And by the way, the independence of Estonia, who runs Estonia? Do we know? No, we don't even know. We don't care. What it means is keeping Putin out. Do we know that Estonians don't want Putin to control or Russia to control Estonia? Do we know how many ethnic Russians are in Estonia who want Russia to control Estonia? No, we don't. We don't care. It's amazing. But we want to kill and die for that. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, it occurs to me that Jeremy Corbyn has, I guess you could say, a similar position on NATO as Trump does. And
well, he's better than Trump lately.
Well, Trump has basically gravitated toward just the norm on NATO. Right. He'll say something here and there. But his administration is staffed with people who are bought in on the primacy of that alliance and of all sorts of other kind of foreign policy.
By the way, do you have any analysis for why that happened? How did he let the generals in?
Well, I mean,
why did that happen?
He was always very laudatory of the generals over the course of the campaign. He wanted their affirmation. He wanted them advising him. He got a couple fringe generals like Flynn in his close circle of advisors. Most of them wouldn't touch him for the longest time. But once you become president, there are certain I think there's a certain new set of obligations that kick in, meaning that people in the establishment who might have been averse to him previously are going to feel
so this
it's
is,
their duty to
this
to
was the characterological flaw we should have been worried about, which is that Trump loved the military brass. He loved a man in a uniform, right?
Yeah,
and I think that's probably true. I mean, who knows for sure, but it seems that way.
And
that's why he let McMaster
and
Mattis basically run the show now.
Yeah. I mean, I think when he came into office, it's not as if there was a roster of people just waiting to be tapped into who generally share Trumpism as a guiding philosophy.
Right.
He had to just tap in terms of staffing the government, which is one of the main tasks that a new president has to undertake. I mean, your options are rather limited. You have the military establishment you can fill a military role with somebody who takes a takes a very kind of deviational view of military affairs. And Obama was beset by similar problems.
Yeah.
It's not as if the CIA director that you choose is going to be like come from the Obama school of analysis. It's going to be a very kind of select set of people.
There you go.
I think that's basically what happened with Trump. And I don't think he cared all that much about it. I think once they were singing his praises, and once he was the commander in chief, he had achieved his goal, which is that, you know, he's running the show.
Yeah. There's this very interesting, what appears to be a faction fight in the White House around foreign policy, right? So we have this struggle going on inside the White House over what to do with Syria and Iran, right? We have these, who's the junior 31-year-old national security advisor kid, Ezra? He's a Frank Gaffney protege, I believe. So an anti-Iranian zealot. Frank Gaffney thinks.
And he had argued for even greater escalation in Syria.
I believe he was trained by Gaffney and David Horowitz, right? The ultra anti-Iranian nutbag neocons, I believe so. And this kid, because he is a kid, I mean, no offense, Michael, but he somehow has gained some sort of power in the White House once. You know, he wasn't kicked out with Flynn. Flynn brought him in, and McMaster, for some weird reason, hasn't been able to kick him out. I don't understand that at all. He's there and apparently close to running the show. Not yet, but he's close to running the show, according to reports, on Syria and Iran, policy towards Syria and Iran. And what he wants to do is go hard right now in Syria against any faction, any militia on the ground who's aligned in any way with Iran, and keep going. Once we kill, this is what I understand from reports, once we kill the Iranian-aligned Syrian fighters or fighters in Syria, the United States military, boots on the ground is what he wants, apparently, will just keep going east all the way to Tehran and invade Tehran, or at least decimate their military. Now, with bombing and boots on the ground, that's serious business, and that's very different than what Bannon and Miller wanted, I think. I mean, they wanted to go hard against Iran, but I never heard them talk about boots on the ground or that kind of what sounds like regime change. Now, I don't understand what's happening because McMaster and Mattis pretty clearly just seized power, booted Flynn, demoted Bannon, and we've not seen any evidence that there's that good old Trumpism really running the show on foreign policy. But now, and now we have this new thing coming from a Trumpist, from a Flynn appointee, this Ezra kid, I forget his name. But so it's unclear. Do you have any sense of this? I mean, no kidding. Like, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of lives are in the balance on this.
No, I think, yeah, it's a gravely serious matter, obviously. I'm always a little skeptical of these palace intrigue questions, like which faction is warring with which. Mm-hmm. Because those stories are almost invariably sourced to anonymous people. And I just think you need to just consider all that with a hint of
skepticism. Well, we know. Okay. So how much this Ezra kid, someone needs to look up what his name is. But anyway, how much this kid's.
I'm looking it up.
How much power he has is.
Well, I mean, one reason why he.
We don't know, but hang on. But we do know he's still there.
Yeah.
Right? McMaster did not purge him. McMaster has purged Flynn and effectively purged Bannon. So why is he still there? And this is a Frank Gaffney protege. Frank Gaffney is a terrifying dude. Frank Gaffney he's harsher is not even the word. He's more murderous toward Islam than the neocons were.
Uh-huh.
He's the ultimate neocon in that way. And in particular toward Iran. Yeah. Now, Mattis hates Iran because apparently, someone in the Quds Force, I guess, killed one of his guys at some point somewhere, mm-hmm. something like that. Anyway.
It's Ezra Cohen Watnick.
There you go. Ezra Cohen Watnick. Everyone should Google him right now. I don't know. If he has no power, then it's no problem.
Well,
although,
I mean, one reason why he might have power is because if he's seen by Trump as a proxy for Flynn, and Flynn can't serve in the government anymore, but Trump nevertheless maintains loyalty to Flynn, then perhaps he... sees the elevation of this Ezra character as maybe a way to show his enduring loyalty to Flynn, given that Cohen was.
You think
Flynn
he still cares
protege.
About Flynn?
Well, I mean, there's been reports that.
Just a sentimental attachment or loyalty?
Maybe Trump still thinks apparently that Flynn did nothing wrong. He's maybe regrets firing him, that he at one point even may have offered to bring Flynn back into the government. So yeah, I think that might be a factor.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I
almost feel it's sort of like fruitless to get bogged down in these speculative discussions about which faction has power over which. I just think there's always a self-interested motive in terms of what information gets out and who it's fed to. Yeah. And it's just a mess and a tangle of.
Okay.
BS.
Here's what we do know. Here's what's really clear. And people still get confused about this. So during the campaign, Trump 60% of the time said, I want to be friends with Russia. I want detente with Russia. I want no regime change. I want interventions only when it is necessary. I want to probably draw down our relationship with NATO, possibly withdraw, at least make the other member states pay more, but de-emphasize NATO as a priority. But, he said consistently, I want to bomb the shit out of the Islamists mm-hmm. in the Middle East, right? Go after them hard. He was never unclear about that, never ambiguous in any way.
No.
And I said, and a handful of us said at the time, huh, on the Middle East, more disaster, possibly greater disaster if Trump is in office, because going harder down there in the Middle East on ISIS or whoever's popping up their head will create more terrorists. The problem will not go away. Very, very bad. I was always clear about this. However, for some of us, Trump was shining a light on something that had never been exposed. No American in the media, in academia, had really thought about this since the damn thing was invented, which is NATO. And America's role as the global cop, right? this globalism, which is more than, is 100 years old or more now, that he had a critique. It was jumbled. He clearly didn't have the greatest grasp on it, but it was there. It was a political candidate running for office who was actually saying these things, that NATO might not be in our best interests, that being the global police officer might not be in our best interests. Maybe we should withdraw from those things, those institutions and roles. That was a little bit exciting for me and others. And that's all I said. I said, but on the Middle East, he's going to be at least as bad as Obama and Bush and all the rest. This is just something I want to talk about at the very least. And I do believe if we do pull out of NATO, my son is safer and I'm safer and Russians are safer and possibly even Western Europeans are safer. I think it's less likely. I think NATO will be the cause of the next world war if there is one, actually. So that's all. And now people are saying, see, we told you he was going to bomb the crap out of the Middle East because of the civilian casualty counts going up in Iraq and Syria, which apparently is true. And I'm like, no, I know this is exactly what he promised. And I knew this and I was always critical of that. But that's just so we're clearing the record here. You know, this is what was said. And so what he has done, Trump has been almost perfectly bad on foreign policy in that he has more or less he's more or less been consistent with his promises on the Middle East, right? Continued the bombing and all that. But what he's reneged on is detente with Russia and leaving NATO. So there's a seems like a renewed commitment to NATO, and he's been aggressive, belligerent toward Russia. So this is no good at all. This is basically Hillary. This is Hillary on foreign policy, right? Is there anything good here or better?
Well, I think the jumbled critique that he had of NATO was always maybe overhyped. I think a lot of people latched on to the scattered comments that he made expressing reservations about very narrow aspects of NATO membership. People who latched on to those were doing so because they thought it would harm him politically. So a lot of the same liberals and centrists and the people who are fans of norms and institutions and those kinds of things, they were very exercised about Trump's NATO comments, and they kind of made it out to be him voicing a principled, coherent critique of NATO, when I think in reality, he was always just kind of annoyed at the very transactional elements of NATO, meaning that
it was bad business.
Like the member states don't pay enough. Mm-hmm. Maybe if I kind of play a card, we can gain a little more leverage over them. It wasn't as – I don't think he never threatened to withdraw from NATO, I don't think. So maybe what it says is the fact that people were so exercised about his very kind of minor quibbles that he voiced during the campaign shows that how even very mild deviations from the mainstream on the subject provoke just a disproportionate level of frenzy. Mm-hmm. Now that he's kind of, you know, transitioned to a more, predictably, I would say, transitioned to a more establishment-oriented view on the subject, shouldn't be seen as a surprise.
But that was not a minor deviation. As I said, no one in the establishment has ever called into question NATO. No one.
Yeah, that's true.
Neither party. And in academia, I've been in academia for more than 20 years now, and I've been around international relations people, and I've been around historians of foreign policy. No, never. This idea never occurred to me even, because it just was never presented to me by anyone, that NATO might not be in our best interests as Americans, as human beings, that it might actually be the cause of the next world war. Never has that been raised in any way. Donald Trump was the first to do it in the public sphere in any meaningful way. So
I think if you go back and look at the comments that he actually made, I think the first time he raised it was in March of last year, and then he raised it again or was asked about it again in July. The comments were not as searingly precise as maybe
seemed. But it was a great opportunity for me and people like me. And here's the thing. Donald Trump is going to cave in on this, but I'm not. He gave me an opportunity, and I'm going to keep going with this. Yeah. I'm going to keep talking about this until we are out of NATO. I don't want to be a part of that thing.
Yeah.
It is a death trap. It is literally a death trap. It's a trap because we're obligated. Now, and by the way, and now NATO is up to the borders of Russia and has been adding more and more member states, and now Montenegro is a member. And how many is it now? 20-something nation states. If any one of them is attacked or claims that they're attacked, we are obligated to go to war for them. We can't even name most of those states.
Right.
I want out of that. So Donald Trump, I will thank him for this one and only one thing. He put that question on the table. He made it possible to at least talk about this. Now, I don't think that idea has been discredited so much by the establishment that we can't talk about it. And in fact, I think we now have an opportunity to do that. So I think you should continue. And I think I should too.
No, I would say hear, hear to that.
Okay. So here, let me tell you this other thing. You, it occurred to me, remind me of Randolph Bourne. Randolph Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E. Are you not aware of him? Wow, you should
be. I'm
not
sure if I am or not.
Wow,
I don't want to pretend otherwise.
I feel good.
Okay.
No, I'm glad that I introduced you to Randolph Bourne. Randolph Bourne was a, you could sort of call him a progressive, left wing, I suppose, semi-socialist, intellectual at Columbia University in the 1910s. Mm-hmm. He was also a humpback. That's sort of neither here nor there. But he was John Dewey's student, okay, at Columbia. John Dewey was a professor at Columbia at the time. John Dewey led a movement of progressives, self-identified progressives. These were true blue believers in progressivism, to support U.S. entry into World War One. And John Dewey wrote a series of articles arguing for why the United States should enter the war. And his main argument was not so much about saving the poor people in France from the German hordes. It was, and this is what he said, there are social, this was the title of an article, there are social possibilities in war. That war requires, necessitates the state taking over spheres of life. So the socialization of industries, the nationalization of industries is necessitated by war. We have to have the government control transportation, communications. We have to have the government control human bodies through the draft to get those people onto those ships and over to Europe. That's why he was attracted to war, and that's why he wanted war. He said this. He was explicit about it. And many, many progressives, in fact, most progressives supported this. They thought that the war would bring about the well-ordered society, a scientifically managed society. They loved the idea of the draft because it made everyone regimented. They wanted a regimented society. They wanted everyone to be connected directly to the state in some way or another. They wanted the state to control the railroads and the food supply and all the rest of it. And they thought that war would get us there. Randolph Bourne was a progressive until this moment. And in 1917 and 1918, right as the United States is entering the war, he writes a series of attacks on progressives and Dewey in particular, in which he says, yeah, this is your problem. I just realized you want to kill thousands, probably millions of people in the service of making this society into a giant machine. I'm no longer interested in progressivism. And I think we should all look at what progressivism really is. It's revealing its true colors now. We now understand the full implications of progressivism, that it wants to kill in order to regiment, that it actually wants, at the end of the day, it wants to make everyone into a soldier, part of the state, fully identified with the state. And Bourne said, this is his famous line, you may have heard this, he said, war is the health of the state.
Yeah, that was the line that came to mind.
So he became a hero to the handful of progressives and leftists who were anti-war then and have remained anti-war since. And he's my hero, even though no one's heard of him anymore. But so you and your career kind of remind me of him because you, right, come out of that movement, generally speaking, and you have now positioned yourself as almost a lone critic of it, but you're kind of attacking it, I think, centrally. I think you're what you're doing is starting to expose what progressivism and its liberal descendants are really about. That the Russia stuff is not just dumb, it also exposes who they really are. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that's...
Fundamentally.
I think that's true to an extent. I think also, again, a lot of this is related to this burning desire to harm Trump, whatever the cost. So I don't think a lot of people who are advancing these types of arguments are necessarily cognizant of the noxious ideas that they're actually promoting in the course of doing that. They view it as the totally virtuous endeavor of trying to throw whatever you can at the wall and see if it sticks. So I think it's an imperative for people who maybe have a more comprehensive understanding and view to kind of try to drill down into the underlying theory. But yeah, no, I think that's a, and does it reflect maladies that maybe are fundamental to contemporary liberalism? I would say yes.
Yeah.
And is the Russia issue a good prism by which to expose those maladies? Perhaps.
Yeah, I think so.
Does that reflect something psychologically about my temperament and why I'm drawn to the issue? Now that you mention it, maybe.
Yeah, you should check out Randolph Bourne. I think you're the modern day Randolph Bourne. I do think you're right that a lot of these people are not conscious of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they're not aware of the implications of their politics. This is the difference between liberals now and progressives then. Mm-hmm. If you read progressives then, they're straight up about all of this and they're very aware of it all. And they have they're not ashamed of talking about wanting a regimented society. They're not ashamed of, you know, using scientific methods to, you know, discover who is genetically inferior. And they're not ashamed of saying, well, the state should determine who is genetically inferior and then we should weed them out through selective breeding, et cetera, or forced sterilization. That was a progressive project, right? They didn't have any shame about that. That's what's different now. But the other thing that's different now, and I think you're right, that their descendants are no longer conscious of this, is that the deeper ideology and the deeper implications of it are just internalized, right? So that when they think about a well-ordered society, when they think about everyone participating in the state or really being a part of the state, and I'm not talking about socialism. I mean, just that connection, that deep ideological or psychological connection to the state that I was talking about earlier. When they think about that, they don't think about killing and bombing and flamethrowers and Nagasaki. They think, oh, a national service organization, right? They think about college students teaching classes in public high schools. They think about building trails in national parks. They think that's where we're going to go. That's where we're going to be. That is what a well-ordered society is, in which everyone is involved with the state. It's about people helping other people. So
it's amazing that they could have that conception of what American state power is, meaning
I know
high school students going to teach in public high schools or trails being
but don't you think?
Made in parks. I, by the way, things that I support, I like,
sure.
I think public parks should be
fine.
Preserved, and I think the state maybe has a role in doing that. But the idea that that's going to be – those initiatives are how you conceptualize American state power, when American state power is – a global hegemon with bases literally worldwide and it's engaged in active hostilities in I don't know how many countries now.
I know.
And so for that to be how you construe what American state power constitutes, I think reflects a very, very almost infantile understanding of what it is.
But that's who they are. Am I right? That's what they think of.
Yeah.
When you ask them, what do you think of the government?
Yeah.
Right? They think, oh, healthcare. Oh, education for the poor. Mm-hmm. It's helping other people. That's what they think. And it's like, well, first of all, we can debate whether socialized medicine and the public school systems has actually been helpful to people. But apart from that, that's just a tiny little sliver of what the nation state has done in its history in this country. Most of what it's done
for a Norwegian, maybe that would be appropriate,
has been to kill and imprison people and to stop people from crossing borders.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we're the world's leading prison state.
Yeah.
We're the world's leading kind of hegemonic military power.
Yeah.
We're constantly engaging in belligerence in all sorts of forms the world over.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, for me, animates my view of what the state is doing more so than these kind of pop culture liberals who see the more innocuous exertions of state power and look at that as the end of the analysis.
So that's what the
and actually I don't want to let conservatives off the hook here either. I mean, when you ask a conservative, and I'm generalizing here obviously, but you ask a conservative what is the government, they don't tend to think of police power as a government function. They'll say, oh yeah, we need small government, which means we have to shrink social welfare spending. That's how they conceptualize it. So I think people created a view of what government power is based on what their personal priorities are.
Yeah. So first of all, I think conservatives are actually much more honest about this. They say, I think this is true for most conservatives, self-identified conservatives, that the government is necessary to kill and imprison the bad guys, right? For progressives, they have bad guys that they want to kill and imprison. They just don't ever talk about this because I think you're right. They don't actually think about it. It doesn't occur to them. Mm-hmm. They think the government and the nation state is libraries mm-hmm. with five-year-olds being read to by a kindly older woman on a Sunday morning. I mean it. I really. So now progressives.
And I love libraries, by the way. I'm in them frequently.
So progressives, I want to be clear about this. Progressives they didn't want bloodshed. They didn't want to kill. They weren't necessarily sadists in that way. Don't get me wrong. They did want the nation state to be nothing but public libraries and public schools and trail services and all the rest of it. They did want everyone to be fully identified with the nation state, and they understood that you had to achieve that mass identification with the nation state, you had to give the people those nice little things. Mm-hmm. But what they understood that the liberals now don't understand is that to get there in any way means breaking a lot of eggs, which means breaking a lot of bodies, right? And they were completely clear about that. So they were for sterilization and wars abroad and stopping immigration eventually and all the rest of it, you know, and prohibition, right? Because that made a chaotic society. Can't have a well-ordered society if everyone's a drunk. Mm-hmm. Something happened, and I'm a historian. I'm giving these lectures right now on history. I don't actually know what happened, but something weird happened where the liberals stopped being aware of this. And so that it's so deeply internalized that they just say, oh yeah, we need to be tougher on Russia, without understanding that what that means is potentially going to war over what exactly? Over nothing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, think of what the progressives in that era were saying. They were thinking of how a society should be constructed.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking at sort of a base level rather than through at a level of just pure partisan maneuvering. And I think that's what so many liberals now are wrapped up in.
Yeah.
And I think that necessarily limits their ability to broaden their conception of what, say, state power is or what the true implications of hostility to Russia are, because they are so immersed in this nonstop cycle of political entertainment and cheekiness and all the other kind of cultural constructs that define what contemporary liberalism is.
Yeah.
And again, that's goes back to why they're so so incredibly animated by Trump as a persona, because again, he's in their space, he's in their pop culture space.
he's taken over their family, Michael. I explained.
I mean, their societal critique almost begins and ends with Trump.
Yeah.
Which is just absurd.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. So what I find myself doing all the time is hearing a liberal say something that's basically vacuous. I mean, in terms of how they understand it, their understanding is vacuous. That has very important implications. And what I do is explain to them, I give them a history lesson and say, oh yeah, that's what your forebears said too. the progressives of old. And here's what it led to. And then they say, oh, well, I don't believe all that rest of that stuff. I just think we should be tougher on Russia, or I think we should, you know, tax people and do this and that. And so what I end up doing is like teaching liberals to be better liberals,
yeah,
to understand their position better, to historicize it, to fill it in, and then to say, now look at this thing right, that you're standing on top of. You didn't even know you were standing on top of it. It's a whole history, guys, which is really, really bloody. Conservatives have been nasty motherfuckers in this country, but compared to liberals over the last 100 years, they have killed a tiny fraction of the people. And I mean kill, right? So if you look at all the big wars of the 20th century, except for Iraq, but even that was a progressive war because the neocons are ex-progressives, and they said so. World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, right? All liberal or progressive presidents running those things. How many people were killed and how many brown people were killed?
And the rationale which underlied a lot of those projects did come from liberal school of thought.
Was to help.
Yeah.
Was to help. Was to save people. Yeah. To lift up the benighted, the poor in Europe first, and then in Japan and Asia. We were going to save the Asians from the Japanese. And then in Korea, the same thing. And then in Vietnam, you know what Lyndon Baines Johnson said what Vietnam was? It was about bringing the TVA, the New Deal, to Vietnam, to the Mekong Delta. That's what we're going to do. We're going to develop it. We're going to bring economic development so that they can live just like us.
You know, looking at my own psychology again, or returning to that subject, I think one reason why I'm very interested to just be sitting here listening to you articulate this analysis of liberalism is like, I think there's not enough analysis of liberalism overall.
Oh, you good. Know, I have a job. Good.
liberals populate the media in large part.
Yep.
Again, there's a conservative caricature of what that means, but it's true that people who are basically just generic liberals control a lot of the levers of power in terms of the media and entertainment industries in the United States. I think that's pretty unsellable.
We have studies that show this. It's indisputable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And yet, there seems to be a lack of proper, again, analysis of what that entails. So a lot of, within those circles, you'll see plenty of analysis of conservatism. And it can be reductive. I mean, it's accurate in certain senses. But you don't get a whole lot of, I think, thoroughgoing consideration of how liberalism functions as a political force in the U.S., in part because people are so used to that critique being made from the more harebrained right. And maybe I view my role as providing a different way to look at that political formation.
Yeah, man.
Right?
Yes. Hear. Keep going, Michael Tracy.
And because I think it's needed. I think you can only do so much kind of like pseudo-anthropological examination of how conservative vehicles out in the country feel about politics. You need to have an actual, you know, a careful look at how liberalism comports itself.
Yeah. So Randolph Bourne, that's one person that you are.
Okay.
And you're also...
And by the way, leftists constantly make this... I think leftists in large part feel similarly to the way I do, in that they make a special effort to analyze liberalism.
Yes. Oh, they're anti-liberal, and they spend a lot of time analyzing liberalism. They don't make my analysis because they love state power too. Anyway.
Well.
That's fine. But it's fine. So the other people you remind me of are the New Left of the 1960s. So some of the most brilliant critiques of liberalism came out of the New Left in the 1960s. Some of my critiques come out of the New Left in the 1960s. If you read them, people like Ronald Radosh, who became a neocon, but when he was a 60s leftist, he was fantastic on this stuff. A lot of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, some of their intellectuals did this stuff. There were a number of very smart intellectuals. Ramparts Magazine Yeah. Robert Shear's magazine.
And Robert Shear is still great, by the way.
Yeah, he's got his moments. But yeah, then he was really great. That sort of milieu in the 1960s was producing really the first critiques of liberalism. I couldn't do what I'm doing without them. Mm-hmm. I think you're serving the same function now. I mean, there's so few now. And I don't know, I still to this day, I don't know exactly why that new left dissolved entirely. It really did. There is no remnant of it. Bob Shear is not that person anymore. He hasn't been for a long time. He's a little bit better than a lot of leftists, but he's not that. I mean, if you want to read the most penetrating critiques of the New Deal, for instance, read Ron Radosh in the 1960s. It's unbelievable. He exposes the whole damn thing as corporatism. He shows, he has evidence that corporations wrote all the New Deal legislature.
Yeah, I think the most...
Legislation, that they wrote them in their own interests.
I think the most incisive chronicler of liberalism as a political formation today is probably Freddie DeBoer. Do you follow him?
Definitely has his moments too, yes. Yeah. Freddie's good. He is good.
He has maybe an emphasis on how contemporary liberalism manifests in the digital sphere, the social media sphere. And mm-hmm. I think increasingly that's becoming a central aspect to all this that has to be taken into strong consideration. And I think one thing that he points out is that there's often a lack of self-awareness among liberals that they are adherents to a certain form of ideology or that they're even members of a political formation at all. They just view it as sort of like a default state of being. And they need to be prodded into recognizing that they are basically functioning as this very exclusive cohort that has a lot of premises that need to be justified mm-hmm. in the public sphere mm-hmm. and can't just be taken as a given, that arguments actually have to be made to people who maybe have different values than you, which is
no
somehow a wild no. idea for a lot of people.
No.
But I think I would point to him as somebody who has a very penetrating insight
yep.
into this.
Freddie DeBoer, everyone should check him out too. I agree. I like Freddie a lot. And he's similar to you in some ways. No, liberals, and I think DeBoer says this, and I certainly agree with it. The problem is if they were just elitists who look down upon everyone else, that'd be one thing. The problem is that they're imperialists, and they want to force everyone to think the way they do. So yeah. They're not interested in talking. They're not interested in having exchanges, right? Am I right? I mean, so they'll shame you. They don't always use state power to enforce this cultural uniformity, but they will certainly use the power of shame.
Right.
Yep.
Or at least a certain style of liberal opinionating mm-hmm. employs that
yeah.
very, very forcefully and ham-handedly in a lot of ways too, which actually creates a reactionary
yeah.
pushback.
Where I'm from, the college campus, that's exactly what they use, is the power of shame. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful they don't have to actually say anything because we're all so afraid of being shamed that we censor ourselves, that we stop ourselves from saying things. Yeah. That's the problem. They want to make everyone, they want to remake the world in their own image.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
That makes sense?
They want to remake the world in their own image, and they want to use, again, but who doesn't want to remake the world in their own image? I mean, who doesn't, I mean, I guess there are differences in terms of how
most
much people
are
willing to impose on others and to force them to accommodate whatever their image of a perfect society is.
Well,
but I think most people in an idealistic sense would want, you know, their personal preferences to be replicated across the board, no?
Maybe. I mean, I think most people just don't care one way or the other.
Yeah.
Christians, of course, were the first to do this, right? It's a Christian thing. It is a Christian thing.
Uh-huh.
And that's what liberals also don't understand, is that they're Christians. They're the last Christians in some ways.
Yeah.
Right? They want to remake the world in their own image. They want to...
And they do threaten people with damnation.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That would be a shared...
You're not wrong. Word. You're not wrong about Trump. You're evil. Haven't you been called that?
I've been called a lot of nasty things. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I don't know that I associate that so much with liberalism as like an ingrained... As an inherent quality of liberalism that they're going to say mean things on the internet. I think it's just sort of like a fact of life.
Mm.
it's sort of like cross ideological.
I mean, I'm sure a lot of conservatives think you're evil, but I know you've been called evil. I've seen people call you evil for having the wrong ideas about Russia and Putin and Trump. So
you know, if I followed, if I kept a close eye on what pejoratives I'm called on a regular basis, I'd probably, and if I let it affect me on a personal level, I probably would have jumped off a cliff.
Okay, so here you go. So it doesn't affect you on a personal level. How has this been? You've taken a ton of abuse.
Yeah, I have.
Daily, every single day. Yeah. For more than a year. How do you do that?
Yeah. You know, on the one hand, you want to think that it doesn't have a personal impact on you, or you at least want to operate as if you can kind of bifurcate your fundamental self from the whatever self is evident for people, the hordes on the internet who are saying nasty things. But at the same time, you have to think that at least over a period of months or years, eventually the torrent of nonstop criticism and vituperative criticism is going to have like an effect on you cognitively, even if it's subconscious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I can't deny that it's had an effect. I mean, how could it not? But at the same time, I've developed a sense of detachment from it where I don't take it as a personal indictment of me as an individual. Because I think for the most part, even the most vicious troll, if I were to sit down with them in a situation like this, you know, with some coffee and, you know, with the laptop and whatever, usually you can arrive at a mutual understanding.
You think so?
I think so. Even if you can agree to – I mean, you can suss out differences in a reasonable, civilized way. And I find that to be available in most circumstances. And I just don't think – so I think knowing that that is attainable kind of leads me to just detach from taking the trolling as some kind of personal indictment.
See, I can't tell if you're just bullshitting right now.
Well, I mean, I'm honestly working through the issues. I mean, I don't have a grand theory of it.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not asking for a theory. I'm asking whether you feel these things.
Well, I mean, yes.
Okay.
I just don't see how it would be possible to not feel them.
Yeah, well,
you're experiencing them.
So the question is, how do you feel? What do you feel?
I don't think anybody could say that being viciously criticized or libeled or attacked unfairly is a positive feeling. Mm-hmm. I think what you can do is simply recognize that putting controversial ideas out in the public space is going to engender some intemperate reactions. And you have to kind of adjust your frame of reference to where those intemperate reactions don't where you don't internalize them as somehow meaning that you as a person are somehow morally flawed, you know?
Don't you have even fleeting thoughts that, oh, maybe there is something wrong with me?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I would mentally articulate it.
I'll tell you that I do.
But I think so. I mean, I think it does. How could it not conjure certain doubts? Mm-hmm. I think that being the subject of a lot of criticism is a positive in that you're constantly held accountable for what you do. I think that's almost superior to operating in a vacuum or a bubble. But it has downsides where you kind of can feel like you're going a little crazy at times. Mm-hmm. I think I try to counterbalance that by corresponding with people who I respect in private, who kind of maybe give me some sense that I'm not totally insane.
Good idea.
I mean, the dynamic of social media does sometimes make you feel as though you are the caricature that people are constructing of you.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I do feel that. I think I feel it every single time. So we're talking about thousands,
yeah,
hundreds of thousands of times. I don't know. Just on social media, if an egg, someone with two followers, you know, and no avatar, says I'm a dumb shit, period, on Twitter, it just is a little bit of flesh taken out of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a little doubt about who I am and whether I'm a good person.
Well, I mean, I think that doubt is almost healthy.
Maybe.
I mean, would you want to be free of doubt? I mean, that would be sort of like having a religious dogma.
Back to our original question, I guess, which is, you know, did we choose good lives? Being political people in the public sphere?
It's funny for me because I don't know that there was a point at which I actively chose this.
Hmm.
It was just sort of...
You chose it every day.
A chain of events that unraveled over the course of time. It's not as if like there was a specific decision made at one point to do something and then that was it.
You chose it every day.
It was just like a snowball
effect.
It's almost as if I didn't really have a whole lot of agency in the matter.
Yes, you did. Come on.
Well, I don't know.
What else would have compelled you to do this, to take on this career?
Well, maybe I have certain temperamental qualities that led me to do it that are inborn. And set me on a certain path, and
it was genetically determined that you'd be a political intellectual journalist.
Genetically and environmentally determined.
I don't think so, man. Here's what I do know, though: you should win the Pulitzer Prize, and everyone should read your Twitter account, and everyone should read you on Medium, and everyone. Do you do videos for the Young Turks now, too?
Yeah, TYT Politics is the channel on YouTube.
Recently hired by the Young Turks. And this is how bad it is for people like Michael, really, is that Cenk Aygır on the Young Turks has criticized you harshly for your ideas about Russia.
Yeah, and I welcome that.
Yeah, no, well, I'm just saying, this is how isolated you are. Even your employer, even the guy who's supposed to be your friend, is calling you out on channel. So
I have to just interject there because I welcome that. And I think, and I mentioned this to you before, mm-hmm. I think having vociferous countervailing opinions within the same journalistic institution is actually a healthy dynamic, and that there is tolerance for a variety of opinions within TYT is not something that.
I guess I just want everyone to be aware.
Disquiets me.
I want everyone to be aware, starting with you, that there is a cost to this stuff that is often not discussed.
Well,
that we ourselves don't acknowledge much of the time.
Yeah, I think there is a cost to it. I mean, I think being deluged with harsh criticism on a daily basis is not something that most people are accustomed to.
Yeah.
And you have to build up certain defenses to it or else it can just be psychologically crippling.
Yeah.
And maybe a side effect of building up those defenses is, I don't know, a certain numbness or a certain inability to feel or something. I think the ability to take criticism and not have it be some kind of characterological, to use that word again, have not interpret it as some kind of characterological flaw is a worthy aptitude to develop.
You've taken a ton of abuse. You've been almost alone in doing it. And what I want to say is that if we don't go to war, you get some of the credit. I mean that. So anyway, thank you for all that. Thank you for doing what you do. Thank you for doing this. Appreciate it.
I enjoyed it.
Good. All right, man. Thank you.
All right.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and to become a part of the Unregistered community, please go to unregisteredlisteners.com. Thanks for listening.